We've started our process of running from committee to committee and starting early in the morning and staying late. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes.
So I apologize for being late, but I was just running from another committee. I thought I saw Representative Gina.
Yes, I saw her too.
Who knows?
Oh, there it is. Hi.
We can use my chair at me.
We're not getting answers to our non-call members.
And, you know, I suspect perhaps them will be late or set. They just finished up in human resources. Morgan will not be here. And what I'd like after this is to grant the other members of my they're not having. And in fact, why don't we?
You can start bringing.
What I'd like is for some of you to come up and fill the seats up here.
Aren't they coming later?
We haven't started, have we? We're being recorded.
Or you want to? Oh, never mind. We're being recorded now. So she needs, you need your spot, right? The Committee on Quality Education Model Review. At our last meeting, and we do have two new members that I'd like to have introduced themselves that just came in.
Pat Moss
is here. Brian?
Here.
Mary Bryant. At our last meeting, we heard the overview of the education, the quality education model that was in draft form. I did have a meeting, a discussion with Representative Lundquist to see when that report would be final, and he tells me that still it's some weeks away. So we still do not have a completed document with which to work from. But you do have, and I'm sure that you all went and spent the last 2 weeks reviewing the model. And and I thought we would take this evening to talk about some of your impressions of the model, so that we can begin to look at how we're going to build onto the model. We're taking minutes of these, so you need to identify yourself for the record, and then we can have the discussion.
Mick, yours?
I do have a question. This is marked as draft, but I have heard the last couple, 3 weeks, references from the governor's office and from others referring to this particular document as final. Where are we? Is this, I'm specifically speaking about the dollar allocation amount that has come out here.
It is a draft. It is still a working document. It is my understanding that it is not, quote, final. And although the model, as it currently exists even in the draft, would allow you to take from, add to, in order to come come up with the budget.
So our job then is going to be to look this particular model over and make recommendations to actually change the model as it's established.
We can, if you remember our instructions from the speaker, we can add to the model. We can refine the model. We can change the model. The model in and of itself is not in concrete. It is hoped that the model would be used as a framework for which we will work from.
Okay. Madam Speaker, I mean, Madam Chair. I want to address that question a little bit too, because that has been a question of mine. But I think one reason why we were so concerned about a group of teachers coming in to look at this is because it's really easy for a certain group of individuals to come up with a plan. I don't want to say easy, but anyone can come up with something like this after a lot of hard work, but we want to make sure it's practical, you know, from the people who are actually going to be at ground level working in this on a day-to-day basis. I think there's no one better than you to really give us an idea of how practical this entire model is. And so that's why we appreciate your participation in this, so that we might really know from you, no holds barred, what you think about it and how it would work from a teacher's perspective.
Madam Chair, you want me to talk to you?
Sure.
I'll get to my name here. When I get to it. Yeah, my name is Tom Gentry. I wasn't able to make it the first meeting, but I did the second, and I finally got the draft. I looked through it the past few weeks, and I talked with a few other teachers down there, kind of told them what I was doing, what it was about, and asked them in particular, if you had any amount of money, I mean, money was no holds barred, would that help you in your education of the children that you're, you know, working with right now? And the answer to their question was, with some students, yes. With others, no. And I look at that myself. I know there's a lot of professionals here, teachers, and they might come up with different, you know, answers to that question. But for me, I look at coming from where I do in Southern Oregon, and the students that I work with, the parents that I work with, no matter how much money you give me to help educate them, I don't know if I'd be able to get to the point where they would be able to pass the Oregon assessment, because there's so much going on in their lives right now that when they come to school, they can't learn because of this disruption that's going on in their life at home. So when you say, is this going to work to help students in Oregon pass those assessments? Not all. I don't even know if it's 90%. I mean, I asked them, and you think nine out of 10 of your kids would be able to pass this? And they said no. And why? Well, for some of the reasons that I just said, and there are an innumerable number of reasons. When they talked about the tangibles and the intangibles, and I have to say there's a lot more intangibles and tangibles that should be looked at that could affect, you know, the education of children. And education doesn't mean just academics. Education means just helping them cope with life. I mean, they're coming in, they can't even... I put an example like this to a lot of people. I say, all right, you're going to work. You just had the worst fight with your wife or your husband that you've ever had. Now, how are you going to do? Their answer is, I'm not going to do very good. Well, this is what kids are coming to school every day. This is what they're living. And yet you expect me to help them academically to get them to the point where they can pass a test? And that, no, there's just too much going on. So, I mean, money's fine. I mean, we need money. Yeah. but there's a lot of other things that would help.
My name is Jennifer Rock, and I think I can suggest why I do for my second graders. I would have to echo a complaint that I had looked at the moral studies intensely, but I've heard the last couple of meetings that you have. I recognize that this is about friendship and about money, and I value that. That the accountability piece of the model scares me, because if there seems to be an assumption that if you're given enough money, then you can help find your degree, and while I do need money, depending on what the accountability piece really demands of, I am more willing to be accountable to being at work. I'm more willing to be accountable to learning best practices, but I can't be held accountable for whether I'm buying my degree. And so where the money piece and accountability piece balance out in this model is interesting and makes me concerned. And all those things are true. Those things everywhere. They come with a lot of baggage. And money is not the only thing, although we give them some tools that, so that I guess the focus of this piece, it has to be on the deductibility that I would remind us that we're talking about.
The qualification, we have another committee that will deal with the funding and that piece. We can deal and address in this committee more the content, and so budget is not the over.
Martin Bronstein from Corvallis.
Yes.
I agree with Tom and Jennifer in part of their remarks about not every student, of course, having the skills or the cognitive abilities and whatever else is required to meet some of the benchmarks and standards we've put in place. However, I sure as heck, as a fourth, fifth grade teacher, I teach a fourth, fifth blended classroom in Corvallis, where we've lost 25% of our licensed staff in the last 9 years since Measure 5, with an increased enrollment in our community. And I sure would like to have an opportunity to teach a class of 20 students and be able to address some of their individual needs, regardless of what baggage they might bring to my classroom. I can't really control a lot of that, although I put a lot of energy into working with parents and communicating pretty effectively, I think. I sure would like to, you know, be able to see what it would be like to have fewer students so that I can really individualize more of my instruction and differentiate between the different needs of my learners and do all the things that I think are really essential for everybody to meet their full potential. I'll kind of let the testing process and the benchmark process, which my students go through now, kind of sort itself out in terms of whether I make it for 90% of my students or not. But I sure would like to have the opportunity to be able to have the resources, including curriculum materials, updated textbooks, and all the things that would really help me out in my effort to try to make the school experience for my students a little bit more successful. I'm also a parent, by the way, of a fourth grade daughter and a seventh grade son. And so I see it from the other end, too, in terms of hoping that the schools in Corvallis, which I have a great deal of confidence in, mainly because of the staff that are there, to provide an adequate education for my children as they go through the Corvallis school system. But I've been teaching there a long time, and I've seen the changes that have had to be necessitated by budget constraints and the incredible flat funding difficulties we've gone through in the last 9 years since Measure 5 and 47. So I'm really hoping that that when we look at the quality education model, that we look at some of the, what I consider pragmatic recommendations, and that is to lower class sizes, to provide more resources, increase the resources so we can provide specialists in the building, including counseling services. We were just talking a little earlier how the Littleton, Colorado situation kind of brings a lot of things to all of us that are in schools every day in terms of what could have possibly been the factors that have isolated and ostracized the students to commit such extraordinary acts of violence. And the time to catch that is not in high school,
or middle school. The time to catch that is in elementary school and primary education ages. And I think the quality education model at least reflects some of that, the all-day kindergarten and some of the other proposals that are in it. So I'd really like us to take a look at that and kind of face the realities of what we've all been going through over the years and hope that we can provide a great preschool to age 21 education like we're really responsible for. Thank you.
The model did not include preschool.
No, it didn't.
And that's something that this that's something that this committee could include. Your task is not to limit yourself, and I think I'd like to make that clear. You're not to limit yourself. We're a group that can dream and make recommendations from our dreams.
Diane McPhillips, English teacher, and you're going to know that I'm speaking for English teachers, but you said dream. And as I look at what the English teachers in my building are dealing with and the English teachers in our district, with 190 students when we have block schedules, 80 students, and we are teaching writing. I also might add we're also teaching without textbooks or classroom textbooks, but we're teaching writing, and writing is one-to-one. So even in this model, it says 29-to-1 student-teacher ratio. And as English teachers, we have noticed whenever research reports come out, they always say, thou shalt not staff English classrooms like social studies and science classrooms. I have a U.S. News and World Report outstanding American high schools, and it says a load of 125 students should be the upper limit for English. Teachers need time to grade essays. Right now, given the pressures of work samples and the bubbling, et cetera, that we're doing in English classrooms, my teachers in my department, and I'm in the department head, are talking about getting out because we cannot manage with 190 students that we see over 2 days. So I am going to continue to remind people, let's look at staffing English classrooms differently.
Madam Chair, I believe that we need to constantly look at what quality education is. The public needs to know what it is and what it costs. Now, admittedly, it's going to be tough to get there, but I think you can't raise people's expectations for the youngsters and then just say that, well, we're going to only go 90%. I don't think there's any throwaway children. Addressing the issue that Diane raised, I'm a retired teacher, and children need time. I was a health teacher, and so many of the problems that they had in their life were brought forward. And in a class period of 45 minutes, and you have 30 children, was that a minute and a half per child? So I again repeat, I think our task is to say what quality education is and what the cost would be. And I think you have to keep remembering that. The other issues will come up naturally, but if you keep that focus, then the public is going to develop trust. Again, we were talking, many people are just so angry at school districts, at legislators, because they're not getting a straight story. And I think it's very important that we develop, kind of get back that trust that we used to have in the education system. Thank you.
They have mentioned the lack of attention to the capital costs in this model. As far as if we want to lower costs, probably means building new schools. And is that something that this committee can address? Is that something that we can rectify, or is that just kind of there's a lack of interest in this model, and so we don't really deal with
that? I'm not certain why they didn't include that. in the model, and I don't see anyone here that was a part of the model.
Mary Bryant, I believe that's because most of capital costs are absorbed by the local levy process and not the state.
Okay. One thing that I would be interested to know is what, if you can arrive at a consensus, or if not, just individually address it, what you think, after looking at the model, what the outstanding precepts might be, what the things are that really impress you as really workable, great idea, maybe need some refinement, but a great premise. Are there some of those things?
Madam Chair, Linda Verdorn from Gresham Barlow. I have been asking that very question of our superintendent, of school board members, and of other teachers these last couple of weeks, because they are acquainted with the draft of the quality education model. Things that jump out to them. Most of the people have no argument with what the model is built on as far as the goals and the standards. One thing that came out quite a few times in my speaking was the idea that if we fund schools to the amount in this model, that 90% of the students are going to meet benchmarks. And everyone said that is not fair to give to the people of Oregon, to say to them that if you invest this much money in your schools, that 90% of the students will meet the benchmarks, because that is not going to happen. For one thing, just looking at their own figures, 12% of the students are classified as special ed. That means that there's 88% of the students left. So all 88% of those students must meet the standards, the benchmark standards. The dropout rate must be zero, and between 16 and 17% of the special ed kids must meet benchmarks in order to hit that 90%. Now, to have all three of those things occur at the same time is very unlikely, and their thinking is that this is not an expectation that we should give the public. It's not realistic. It's not right for them to expect that many kids are going to meet benchmarks. That doesn't mean that those kids that don't meet benchmarks, that we cannot do something for them, that we cannot help them to achieve a lifestyle where they can support themselves and be contributing citizens. But it doesn't mean that they're going to meet benchmarks.
Representative Urquhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had some thoughts about that also. So I went out and had some discussions with people who were on the committee, the Quality Education Model Committee. And what I learned from those conversations are that the 90% does not include the special ed. They're talking about those people that, and again, maybe we need to have somebody come back from the committee and clarify that with us. And the second thought was that the 90% is not saying, well, we just want to arrive at 90% and we don't care about the remaining 10%. It was just tying a figure, what it would cost to reach 90%. And that is not the ultimate goal. The third thing that was explained to me was that even if you're not in the 90%, you have not failed. There's a diploma that's available. I mean, all kids aren't on the same level, perhaps, or can reach the same goal. I mean, our thrust is to reach the goal. Of course, that's a state goal. But being realistic, maybe no matter how hard you try, that won't happen. But you should never say that 10% or whatever the percent will be has failed, because they haven't failed. They will just come at it by a different way. It may not meet the benchmark, but we'll have a diploma and can go out and do in life what many kids, now adults, have done in life, that they haven't, the level they reach is just a little different, but they've been able to be successful. in life with the skills they have. So that, in that having that discussion, I felt a little better about it, but I also came to the conclusion that we need to have somebody from the committee perhaps talk to us in more depth about the 90% than just each one of us going out and having individual conversations with different members.
Chair, Carol Dietrich, to talk about that, don't you think, since we are teachers, that the people to talk to would be the teachers, like she was addressing, because those are the frontline workers, and it seems to me that those are the people, not another committee member, but rather the people who are dealing with children every day.
But we need to know what the committee meant. I'm not asking them, I'm not saying talk to the committee for answers, but we need to know what the committee meant itself in this report about the 90%.
Mm-hmm.
So we're clear on that.
A follow-up?
Yes. Follow-up.
Linda Bedorn, my concern is not so much, I think that we can reach a consensus, an agreement. My concern is what you're presenting to the people of Oregon and what they are going to believe about this. That, we're shooting for 90% with these qualifications. That doesn't really cut it with the public.
I think Chair had a problem. Madam Chair, I was really going along with what she said. I think that we need to be very clear of what we are calling a quality education. And if we have that, we're saying that we want to have all children educated. Now, the benchmarks add a real problem, but I think as educators, that's what our goal is. That was brought us into the profession. And I think that we need to be heard on that, because I think we're the ones that talk to parents.
I agree, but we have to start with the fact that this quality education model is already out there in the public, and we may come up with something different, but the public is also going to want to know what does that quality education model mean. So I think it's important for us, whether we agree with it or not, to know what they meant by 90%. Otherwise, we cannot speak intelligently about it with the public who's going to be asking us those questions. I would also add, because, again, I was concerned whether there was teacher input or not, they did have teachers on the committee. I think they were retired teachers. I don't know if they were active, but...
Madam Chair?
I want to clarify for Representative Urbelot, who wasn't here. When the model is completed,
mm-hmm.
and when it is no longer in draft, we will bring the individuals back. But it was felt that after the last meeting, mm-hmm. I should no longer deal with the draft document. They were comfortable with that. So I'm on the way. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then one thing that I want to go back to is I'm getting the impression that one of the fundamental weaknesses of this, after all said and done, regardless of how we define 90%, is that there's no typical student, there's mm-hmm. no typical child. At least I think that's what I'm hearing you say, and that it's pretty hard to make claims based on the fact that there is no typical student that can be delivered to any specific spot or any specific amount of money.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, from reading the list of people that drafted this, I only saw one teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So the inclusion of teachers is, you know, there may be some administrators who are long been out of the classroom, but specifically, I have two things I'd like to say. When we talk about even taking out those students who are special ed, we have a whole other group of students which we classify as 504 who are not learning disabled by certain federal guidelines that have learning difficulties. In addition to that, we have a large influx, at least in my school, of ESL students, Russian-speaking, Spanish-speaking, Romanian. These children passing the benchmarks is a huge problem for them, literally because they don't have a language. They have a language barrier. So how do we deal with that when you talk about this 90%? One other issue that I'd like to mention, and that is, I've shared some of this with the teachers that I work with. the draft itself does specifically say schools that are not making progress to reaching the goal, and the goal is that defined as 90% reaching the benchmark on time, would be assumed to be violating the assumptions of the model. Making adequate progress toward improving student performance, the state would investigate the reasons for the lack of the goal attainment, respond accordingly after the analysis the school did not meet the target performance level. It sounds like there's some sort of a hammer or a consequence. This is not, as I read this, not just, well, this is 90% and we want people to kind of get there and, you know, this is, there's something else involved here that I don't think we're getting the full information about. And I really would like to investigate that. This is something that alarms the people that I work with for all the reasons that have been mentioned here before. You know, so many factors in controlling student performance that is an issue that needs to get answered, at least so that I can talk back to the people that I've been talking to. What's involved in this?
Okay. Tom Gentry.
Similar question about all that. But mine was also where they talk about additional time for students having trouble reaching standards. We've been talking about that in school, trying to reach out to those kids that are having problems. And what we found, being in a rural area where busing is the biggest thing, is that for those kids, if you're going to have a pre or even an after school type of program for them, it's getting them there. And usually those type of kids will not get there. Their parents won't bring them. So are they ever going to get improvement by doing something like that? No. Mainly their improvement's going to come in the school during the school day. And therefore, are you going to work on reading and math with them, or are you going to work on other things? So you got to focus in on where you want to help those kids. And it's going to take extra manpower to do that. So you got to look at that very carefully.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize first for being late. A couple of us had another thing we had to go to. The 90% issue has come up in practically every committee that I have sat on since I got here, and in every school board meeting I've attended, at the whole idea of leaving out, and there's two sides to this. One group says you can't leave out 10%. 90% is wrong because you have to teach 100% of the kids. And I think in our heart of hearts, we'd all like to do that. But I was a teacher for 18 years, and I'm here to tell you I didn't teach 100% of the kids all that they should have learned for all practical purposes. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of value to the folks who are saying maybe 90% is almost too much. I didn't quite follow the math there, but taking out, first of all, some of the kids who don't have the intellectual capacity to do that, taking out some of the kids who are ESL, that are going to need additional help, time, money, staff, whatever you want to call it, maybe 90% is too much. And I agree with all of that. I don't know that I could throw a dart and pick a number. But I think what both the Department of Ed, and I wasn't part of them, but what has been done on a number of these is let's hit 90%, at least as a figure that we can work from, and let's take into consideration the ESL and some of these other things. Maybe that's too high. Maybe that's too low. Maybe we need to make some adjustments to that, and I think that's perfectly valid. I guess my other comment was in regard to the hammer, because I too have read it several times, and I think there is an imperfect understanding in there that if these schools don't, or if the schools don't get to where they're going to do, something needs to happen. And I guess there's two ways to look at it, a hammer or help. And I guess I've chosen to look at it, if my school can't make it, then somebody's going to come in and help me. I think that the public wants that. I really believe that. And I know it's hard, and I get very defensive. Those who know me well about schools can get as defensive as the next person. On the other hand, maybe we need to be more willing to have help, too.
May I respond? Yes, Chair. I'd like to clarify what I meant by the hammer. And I agree. We all know situations where teachers do need help. for whatever reason. And but this is tying funding directly to student performance. And the concern that they were looking at is that if the students don't make the performance, that somehow that's going to be related to the funding issue. That's because that appears to be the way it's tied into here. So it's not so much that if students are not making progress as defined by the 90% or whatever figure we have toward meeting benchmark and getting remedial help or whatever, it had to do with the funding issue. That somehow it would reflect on the amount of money that they get or lack of.
I hope they get more. That was one fallacy I saw in some of the earlier things, the idea of taking money away from the poor schools. I always had a little trouble with that one. I think that, and I don't look at it as teachers. I look at it as schools or classes or whatever, because I think we are focusing on the kids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. And talking about the 90% goal, I think possibly one aspect of it is to consider when would we get there. For example, we've heard statistics that indicate that today or this year, I guess last year's test, third graders are doing reasonably well. And the assumption is, as they go on through school, working on assessments and standards and so on, by the time they get to the fifth grade and the eighth grade and the 10th grade, they will be approaching the 90% figure. But that would be assuming a long period of time. For example, I have some figures here that say today, third graders reading are 78% are at that level. Math in the third grade, 67%. Reading in the fifth grade, 66. Math in the fifth grade, 62. Writing in the fifth grade, 50. Now, it goes down as the kids go get a bit older, but those older kids have not had the benefit, let's say, of previous year's instruction on assessments and standards and that kind of thing. So one assumption is that as we give ourselves some time, results will improve. Another thing now, for those who are not doing so well, built into the model is remediation, which I think primarily is summer school rather than after school. After school is a part of it, but also summer school. And the assumption was it would be the very best teachers in the school who would be doing that remediation, and that would be that could be a powerful impact. And I think in the long run, it's also alluded to the fact of what if some schools aren't doing so well because our model is the school. There would be able to, with the database initiative out there, you could compare what good schools are doing, what is working at the good schools, those schools coming close to 90% or something like that, and then compare to see what the schools who are not doing so well, what they are doing. And maybe by having some objective comparisons, you wouldn't need a hammer necessarily, but there'd be some reasonable assumptions that would perhaps improve the schools not doing so well.
As we look at study groups, it appears as though there is a large interest in the area of the 90% and how we got there, whether that percentage should be different, and if that is an area of interest. We need to begin to start thinking about areas of interest in this group. And so as we talk, staff is taking vigorous notes to kind of to begin to define the areas of interest as it relates to the model and where we go from here. And
Madam Chair, one of the things that we could perhaps work on is what some of you have addressed. And that is if you go through this whole thing way at the end, it doesn't say that they've come up yet with the consequences of this. And I think the public would feel very comfortable if they knew what those were. And we've already addressed some of them. We say, well, don't cut the person. I don't think you should cut the ones that are having a hard time. You should give them help. But if those consequences are identified in our model, I think that would be a strong point. Excuse me, please. And also, Vice Chair Hobson, one of the questions I have about the 90%, and as you can see, I'm strong on feeling all of the children, and also Representative Zachman, why say a figure when the teachers are saying that sets up wrong expectations. I think still saying to a parent, we want to educate your child, I think it's better to use that approach than to say a figure that some people say, well, yes, and some people say no. So I think you got to be realistic is what I'm saying there.
I'm Mary Bryant, and I work here at the Capitol, and I've been former teacher, taught 17 years in public schools here in Oregon, and I've been looking at the quality of education model for quite a while. I have several questions as to why things were and decisions were made the way they were on the committee. So I talked to Gary Conklin, who was on the committee, and also Peggy Lynch from Corvallis, who was on the committee. One of my specific concerns was the 90%. When I asked those two about it, they said that, I said when you examine the benchmarks and the standardized tests that the kids have to do, I said, is that how you came up with the 90%? And they said they never looked at the test. And I said, how did you come up with the 90% then? And this was the reason I was given, and Representative Uberlau, I don't know who you talked to. One was they wanted to set it really high. That was one of the reasoning. Two was there was a lot of pressure. Frankly, there was a lot of pressure by the business community to set it high. And there were a lot of business people on that. And business people, unfortunately, don't spend a lot of time in the classroom. And I think that's part of the reason. But it's also in the fact that they want us to have set it high, but to include populations like they've included. Somebody made a comment about they thought that the maybe ESL and special ed are out. They're not. As far as I read this model, they are included in the testing. And I think this is an area that we really need to take a look at, because I've been around the building long enough to know when the public gets a hold of something like 90%, and you tell the public that this is what you're shooting for, there becomes an automatic expectation that that is what is going to be reached. And the teachers in this state are under a whole lot of pressure in many, many different ways. And I believe the quality education model has some good things, but I also believe it's put more pressure on people who already feel a great deal of pressure. I think there's also been talk in the circles of leadership about modifying SIM and CAM, going with SIM, putting CAM somewhere else. There's lots of things and lots of things to talk about here at the Capitol that has to do with making education a quality experience for our kids. What I was told with this particular model was it was a costing model. In other words, how this is one way to spend money for schools. I cannot make the leap between this model and it becoming quality education. I don't see that we can look at the model, see the costing, and say, okay, if we do this, we'll get there. I do not see it in the model. I don't know how the model can tell us that we can do that. So I think we have to be real careful in looking at adopting something like this as the model for what is the optimum in our state. It is asking us that 90% of our kids pass these benchmark tests. But what about the other things that we use to measure kids with? Are they totally eliminated? So aren't we going to look at portfolios anymore? Aren't we going to look at other the SATs and the ACTs and all those kinds of things? If this is the only way we measure success, is that these children meet the 90%, I don't think that's healthy for our state. So I have some problems with the model, and I have a lot of problems in the fact that more teachers weren't part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a teacher anymore. As a matter of fact, Senator Bryan is my husband. And I think we've got to step back and take a real, real tough look at this. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
domain.
Yeah,
did?
Sorry. I thought you were coming.
That's fine. I have a couple things I'd like to follow up on what Mrs. Decker has just said, or Bryant just said. We're making an assumption here that the measurement of benchmark is a set deal. I can tell you from my experience, there is a lot of trouble right now in agreeing on whether students are really meeting benchmark and whether those benchmarks are set correctly. As an example, to follow up with Representative Backlund's figures, last year my eighth grade students, 40% of the students passed the eighth grade math benchmark last year. This year, after another whole year of working on reform, 20% passed, 29%. Now, we didn't do anything much differently, so something is wrong to make that kind of a change in the scoring. So for us to start talking about students needing some level of proficiency when we have that much discrepancy in the assessment means that we, before we start making such a claim, we better make sure that what we're, that our assessment tools are really in place. And that's an issue. I mean, what are we not, this is our eighth year of reform, and if that were the case, I believe in here said by the year 2002 we're supposed to be the best educated in the nation. We better get fast, moving fast. So I think that that's one of the issues that we need to talk to.
Nick, along that line, we can invite the department to come in at our next meeting to discuss that issue. Would you like, would the committee like to have the Board of Ed come in to address the issue of benchmarks and give us where they are and give us an overview from their perspective?
Madam Chair, if I may address that issue, I believe they're also meeting just frequently with, or very soon as represented with some Paris Education Committee on that very same issue. So that might be another place that that information could be brought back.
But we can invite them here to come and make the presentation to us so that all of us can hear the presentation at the same time, if the committee desires to do so.
Representative Pinella.
Madam Chairman, I really, my personal opinion would be, suggestion would be to have them at a separate meeting. But if by the time they make a presentation and we have any time for questions, our time will be up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So is it the committee's desire to have them come to our next meeting?
Chair is going to be the doctor.
The doctor. Until the report is final.
Which is two weeks away?
That's the best guess.
Oh, okay.
All right. Isn't that your understanding?
I know it's not finished now. I don't know what it will be.
We know the department is available. We don't know if the report is completed and will be available within 2 weeks.
Chair Winters? Carol Gertner?
Chair.
Who from the department? Would that be the superintendent or?
Who would you like to have?
Well, he's newly elected. I hope that he's open to a lot of ideas, so perhaps Dan Bunn would be the appropriate person.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we can certainly extend that invitation to Stan Bunn. It'll be his call as to who he sends, if he wants to, represent just assessments and standards. Is that what I hear you're interested in?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Hi, Chair Winters. I talked to Stan Bunn yesterday, and I asked him questions about the very things we're talking about, and he said he'd be glad to talk to me in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks?
Uh-huh.
So he will be around in 2 weeks?
Well, that's what he said. He said, get back to me in 2 weeks on this.
We'll extend the invitation.
If we have a timeline at all.
Yeah.
Yes, I have, I guess, a comment. I just asked if we, most committees have a written charge. I guess we don't. I know the speaker came in and spoke with us, but one of the things I hear going on now, and it certainly was not my understanding that it was part of what we were going to be doing, and what I'm listening to is we're talking about we're going back in time, in one sense, and looking at the Reform Act and the expectations under the Reform Act, and then, of course, now the assessment tools on that Reform Act. It's not my understanding that that's what this committee was going to do. The Reform Act and the expectations are in place, and we have to deal with them in place. Now, if people have the idea that they don't agree with the Reform Act and they want to go back and repeal it or make changes, I don't see that as this committee's charge. And maybe we need to make that clear.
Well, I think from an informational standpoint, that you have individuals in this body who have questions, and as they look at the totality of even putting together a quality model and the refinement, that's a part of the information flow that they need in order to make some judgments. And I don't see it in any way negating or changing the Reform Act. I think we do have questions that people have, and it's just an informational exchange.
Well, it could be, but, you know, without a charge to a committee, what happens is you're very inefficient and you end up not really coming to a conclusion, and that's why I think it's important. And I'm not saying that we should shut the door on the information, but I think it has to be clear to the committee what we are about, or otherwise we're going to be all over the place and not come to any resolution.
Madam Chairman? Well, could I just ask, what is the end result of this committee? What's our goal? What is our goal?
The goal of this committee is the charge that was given by the speaker that was here was to take the model and to build on it, to refine it. That this committee was not limited as to its recommendations to the next legislative session. That it could look at the broad spectrum. She did not in any way put any restraints on this body, if I recall her comments, but said that quality education is important to Oregon, and this is a model to begin from. She did not say to destroy the model. She said that this is something that we can look at as a framework and to build, and that she expected this body, the next legislative session, to come in with its recommendations for quality education for the state of Oregon. Did I miss anything from those?
Can I follow up, Madam Chairman? Are we, so then are we trying, like they were, the teachers were suggesting that they wanted a change in, like the 90%, we could change that 90%. And then follow up, Madam Chair, are we trying to find out also what it costs to educate a student in Oregon or come up with a model plan of what the price is?
There is another committee which is chaired by Representative Strobeck, who is responsible for looking at the financial aspects of the model. And at some point, I suspect that the two will get together, but his committee is addressing the funding issue. Representative.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. You know, I really value the time of the teachers because they came here to tell us whatever they have chosen to tell us. And I appreciate that. If that's the fact that we're building this whole thing on a house of cards, you know, I'm willing to listen to that. And so I think really what we're wanting to know is this quality education model built on a legitimate premise? And we started out on that discussion tonight, and we rapidly landed on the square that there was no possible way that 90% or that any particular amount of money could guarantee the successful delivery of 90% of the kids to any specific destination. And we've heard that doesn't work for a couple of reasons tonight. And I guess, you know, I work in the advertising business. That's really what I do for a living. And, you know, when you advertise that something is going to be 90%, you better, by golly, deliver 90%, because the perception of the people is that 90% means 9 out of 10. You know, in 9 out of 10 cases, it's going to happen without any asterisks, fine print, or disclaimers in the ad. And so that's what 90% means. And if that doesn't mean 90%, we better figure out what 90% is. But I guess the thing that we really want to get back to here is this quality education model usable? And what aspects are usable? And if the fact that there's no such thing as a typical student, if that is the linchpin of this entire discussion, then we've got some real serious problems with the whole thing. And so if that is a major component of this, if that aspect is what this whole plan is built on, or even a major part of it, we need to know from your opinion that this thing is not workable and it's going to have to go somewhere else.
You know, we seem to be very hung up on the 90%, and to me, the model recognizes in a few places that individual districts need to make choices about what's appropriate for their own district. And in my relatively short career as an educator, I've had the opportunity to work in probably one of the highest socioeconomic schools, and now I currently work in one that's probably low average. And what I've noticed is that there is an enormous difference in what those individual schools and districts can actually accomplish. Where the school I formerly taught in, 90% probably isn't a high enough goal. The school I currently teach at right now, 60% is probably way, you know, too high. And so, to me, it seems to be, why couldn't that percentage, that requirement, also be left up to the individual district? Because in some schools, if they reach 70%, they might be phenomenal teachers that are just doing extraordinary instruction, where in other schools, they might be hitting 80, 85, and, you know, it being very mediocre. They just have a different starting place with the children that they have. And so to me, in the places where we recognize that individual districts maybe know their own children and individual teachers know their own children. And I don't know, I mean, I wish I had some great way to say how you could build that into the model, but it scares me to advertise that to, you know, look, we can buy 90% success when we might be, you know, ecstatic over 70% success in some economic areas.
Well, you know, if I might add, I thank you for saying that, because what we've been told over and over about this model is that this is an accountability thing. This whole thing has been devised to let the public know what they're getting for their education dollar. So the bottom line is then, you give us this amount of money, we'll deliver this amount of kids to this destination. So I appreciate you saying that.
I personally have no problem with some accountability. There needs to be that built in some manner. But, you know, when a lot of teachers are just bending over backwards to work so hard to get their kids to move up and, you know, begin to get to a point where they might reach a benchmark, it's kind of sad to, you know, say, well, you know, the state's going to walk in and try and help you out and sorry you're not doing a good enough job when they're doing everything they can. Where in other areas they might not be, you know, working on deliberately.
Martin Bronstein from Corvallis. I also want to kind of direct the conversation back a little bit. The quality education model was designed with a prototype school in mind and resources to that school, making certain assumptions that obviously can be adjusted for the individual schools that we all work in, because there is no real prototype school that we can kind of just duplicate and spread all over the place. So I think that while the discussions about individual students and the 90% and all the goals that we set are important, I think we need to kind of stay focused on what will the model do to help us try to adequately resource schools, if I can use that as a verb, consultation here with the English teachers. If we can provide proper resources and then create a school environment, no matter where, what community that school might find itself in the state of Oregon, they would have the resources in order to educate as best they can the students in their community without, hopefully, taking away the local options and decision-making that school boards and administrations and site councils and teachers and staffs, ESP staff, can have input to in order to best design their own programs. I just think that we need to kind of refocus ourselves back to the idea that this is a model that's designed to provide schools with the kinds of quality resources they need in order to provide the education to that incredibly diverse population of students we all have.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Merkley.
Well, I'm not an educator, so in a room full of educators, I should just start by noting I'm approaching this probably only from my experience as a student. I appreciate the comments that were just made because they were along the lines I was thinking, in which I think that we're starting from the question of how do you cost out what education should cost the state to provide a basic high-quality educational opportunity to our children. That's the underlying goal, and we start within the model. We start talking about what are our assumptions regarding class size, regarding number of counselors, regarding a budget for textbooks, and all of this is fairly, in my mind, a common sense approach to answering a very basic question of how much should the state plan and resources to be able to provide to educate our children. I think that where this conversation gets much more complicated is when we then say, maybe this does come from a business influence of how will we measure the outcome and how will we advertise, how will we sell this product, how will we sell this amount of resources, and well, we can state out we're going to have a goal of so many kids passing the exam. Well, the exams are easy enough, it could be 100%. And if they're hard enough, it could be 20%. And I do think it's probably not a bedrock number, and we're probably headed into a lot of trouble with that kind of approach. I think we should be able to probably agree that 100% of the kids should have an opportunity for a quality basic education. And converting that opportunity into how many avail it of themselves is going to vary dramatically based on the preparation with which kids come to the school, the education ethic of the community, and so on and so forth. And I think, again, that's kind of basic common sense that probably we could get our hands around. So I don't know how we'll end up resolving that, but just want to acknowledge that it's been kind of going from the common sense to the marketing that we get into this complex discussion over the percent, and maybe it is not a path that's ultimately fruitful, but I think we need to think about why people went down that path and think about whether it's necessary to do so and what other alternatives we might have if we don't choose that particular path.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mercury spoke in part to my thoughts, and earlier I wanted to speak to Martin's comments, but one of the potentially good things I think about the model is it gives you some objective, tangible things to identify. So whatever the percentage of success of the students would be, you can go back to, what was the class size? Was it 29 or less? Was it 32? And if the class sizes are very large, you could expect them probably they're not going to do very well. What about tests? What about computers, as Representative Merkley said? Professional development should be 10 days a year. What if teachers are getting none or two? Well, probably then your product, your percentage of success is not going to be very good. What about this model here says extra time for students. 20% of the kids should get extra time. And if they're not even approaching that or getting none, then we have a long ways to go to provide a quality education. And of course, you look at intangible things. You can estimate that the leadership of the principal is really pretty important. It's not something you can put your thumb on, but you can tell that the leadership of a good school is very, very noticeable. And how much parental involvement is there? How much homework is assigned? So you can break some of this down into tangible, objective things you can put your finger on, your thumb on, and then go back and see how is that school doing in terms of the assessments. So that could be one of the positives of this model.
Let me go to the end and then look at that.
Backlund's comment that maybe talk a little bit to Representative Wilson, and that is, I think you've highlighted the strong point of it. Where it's weakest, in my perception, is that it doesn't identify what measurable gain you'll get in the quality of education for college students. In other words, I've heard now several times this evening, and apparently, perception of a lot of us, and maybe it's fact, that class size is a major factor relative to overall performance. And so if you took that factor and said that's the number one thing that's not being funded currently, and then you put the number two thing, I don't know what it might be. It might be textbooks, it might be extra instruction, whatever it might be. And if you identify what we perceive to be measurable improvements versus dollars, then you could then transfer that to the other committee or elsewhere to make financial decisions. But I would think that that's where we could provide an input. That could be useful.
We're working our way up this way now.
Okay. Madam Chair, Diane McKillop. As I began this committee, our meeting work plan included a presentation on the status of education reform, which I think is maybe going to be the next time we meet. And I think all of us as teachers would tell you that the status of education reform changes daily. Okay, and I think we would be very interested in getting a feel for what is the current status, because there is, as the agenda says, an interplay of this reform, the reform goals, and the goals of the education funding model. And some of us, it would just be interesting to see, you know, what the current status is. We know, for example, just in math scores right now, and that's, he alluded to the difference in the percentage of passing. All of our scores have been held up in terms of a draft, and because we have, the scores are unofficial because of the tremendous change in rigor at fifth grade last year in terms of math and fifth grade this year, and we're seeing tremendous drops. So, again, the role that this plays and how we're going to look to the public is a major concern for us because of this changing status, changing social studies, problems with tests. And so I think as teachers, we're interested in the status of school reform as it currently stands.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Wilson and Backlund, your questions were very valid, and that is getting back to the quality education. What does that mean? And putting the price tag on it. I see that as our charge. And I think the components of quality learning on page 46 of that class size one, professional development, big time, duration of instruction time. Again, time is a major factor when you're educating a child. And then the operational support, you know, the libraries and business and financial. So to me, that's the starting point in, and that's one of the strengths of this model. And I think starting from that, I think you're hearing a lot of our frustrations as teachers about some of these other things, because ultimately we are accountable to the public. You know, why aren't you getting my child? Is he that one out of ten? That's, you know. So I think that's a good starting point. It's one of the strengths, and we should pursue it. And as I said before, one of the weaknesses are the consequences, and that's what it doesn't deal with. And it says at the end they're still working on that. So, you know, that could be a starting point.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I think it's important to remember that life isn't in black and white terms.
Mm-hmm.
Life has a lot of nuances, and I'm looking at these components of quality learning, and I'm seeing class size, professional development, and so forth, extremely important. But once you get past those, you have to look at your student mix. Do you have students who are coming
from abusive homes, that's going to affect how they can learn. Are you having students who speak English as a second language? You have people coming to school who haven't been fed in the morning. So those are those things that we don't have total control over. We acknowledge that, though, and move on and say we do have control over these things.
Mm-hmm.
And in addressing them, we can make some progress. And I guess I have the same thought on the reforms. The progress we're making on the reforms, a very important component of that is how the community accepts the reforms, how the leadership of the school accepts them, how the teachers accept them. I've been in schools where the community, the leadership, and the teachers are extremely enthusiastic, and you can see a difference in that school than schools that I've gone into that, why are you doing this to us? So there's always these nuances that you have to take into consideration when you're looking at any of these things, and I would just caution that we do so.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I have a question. There's a letter apparently people have received from Lundquist, and this is the first time I've seen this. I'm not going home today. I think it was in the mail. Can I have a clarification on what is referred to as final draft, and what our role is in relation to that final draft, or what is the final draft going to be used for?
Well, at our last meeting, Representative Lundquist advised us that the document in which we were reviewing was in draft, and that they had not completed all of the information going into the document. And so he asked us not to look at the document that we have currently as a final product, that they were still in the process of completing the document. So what you have before you is not the final document. I spoke with him, I believe yesterday, and to ask when would that document be completed so that we can go forward, and he told me within a couple of weeks.
Can I have a follow-up? Then the final draft that we get will be still a working draft. I mean, it's not a final draft in the sense that that's going to be the report that's presented.
Excellent.
Okay, I do too.
I'm sure.
Just
one final thing before I have to go and start on my homework for tomorrow. You know, you work in one of the most confusing environments I've ever seen. You know, I've got to tell you, my experience, I'm a first-term legislator, and I've been in the broadcasting business my whole life, living with the FCC, and I thought my relationship with them was confusing. And I get up here, and I have had an opportunity to be on Ways and Means Education and the full Education Committee, hearing now hours and days of testimony. And I'll tell you, I find the education environment today one of the most confusing things that I've ever seen. I've changed my mind on some days three or four times about who's to blame in this whole thing. I finally decided there's probably enough to go around for everybody. But, you know, I'm really sympathetic to the environment that you work in, and I am really hoping in the months and very short years to come, I hope, that everything from assessments begins to clear, where we're going with education reform clears, funding clears. To me, it's nothing short of amazing, and I would just hope that not many teachers on a percentage basis are giving up in futility over what's going on, because I know that if I had employees in my own business not knowing what is going to happen next to the level that so many of you are, I would have a really hard time keeping them working, keeping them, you know, giving them a reason to show up every day. That would be so difficult. So I don't know why I've said this other than just to say I really hope that we can deliver some meaningful clarity to what you do before people just give up and don't want to do this anymore. So,
Glenn
Colangelo, Can before you leave, can I say something about what you just said?
Sure.
I've taught school for 17 years, and I'm a parent to 24. And I quit my job as a teacher so that I could spend 100% of my time trying to help legislators understand the confusing system that you just described. And I haven't said anything up to this point, and I want to read this no matter what before you go, because to me this is like what it takes, and if I only spoke once in all of the time that I've been in any of these things, this is it. It takes good workable curriculum, which assumes that you have a planned, sound curriculum that includes the materials and the textbooks and all that stuff. It takes a competent, determined, nurturing teacher, a student who wants to learn and is ready to learn, parents / adult role models in today's society to learn, parents or adult role models who offer encouragement and assistance, a safe place. I think all these things can be done, by the way. I really do. And my heart's beating a mile a minute because I feel so strongly that this can be done because the people care so much and they want to solve it. The sixth one is time, and I put under time for people to be alone, the teacher, the student, and the parent, time together between the teacher and the student, time together between the parent and the child, time together between the parent and the teacher, and time together with the parent, the teacher, and the child, and then two more, a sense of vision or direction, and the last one, a foundation of uncompromising virtues, moral values, and ethics. And all of those can be done. And I am telling you, all the people that are here, I'm dedicating my life, starting actually when I quit my teaching job in July of last year in the Salem School District, to help with all of these. And I really think that it can be made sense of, because my heart beats a mile a minute when I hear the teachers talk about how they feel about this, because they are working and trying so hard to make sense of the whole system. And when I stand up and say this, now I can say this because I'm not a teacher anymore. I feel very strongly about this, and I feel that you really want to help. I feel that all the people really want to help. Understanding the system, that's a tough one. And I feel like I understand it. It's really scary, and maybe it's a delusion on my part. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say, and I wanted you to leave with those ideas because I still think that focusing on what we're really trying to do is what matters.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. The only thing I would say in leaving is the ideal situation that you describe, unfortunately and painfully for me, reminds me of my elementary school years from 1958 to about 1965. Life was like that then.
Yeah.
And, hey, I'm not saying it's unattainable except for maybe the parent child contact time, unfortunately. But, it describes for me the way I remember my elementary school years, those good things like that.
I want to reiterate that you're here because we needed your input. And we needed to hear from you in working to build the document. And it doesn't take, I want to make it, we're not taking anything away from the model. I think the model is a place to start, and I think the model is good. And I want to repeat that so that everybody understands that it is not the intent of this body to any way take away from the model. But the model is an excellent starting point. I believe, and I think others do too, that we can refine and build on what is here.
Madam Chair, Jennifer Ross, one of the things that I wonder that maybe you can do that I should come for an intellectual talk for is I heard the process and what it is to help us reach the standards that have been set for us. But I've also heard an underlying thought of what am I going to get for the dollar when I deliver it? What is the business plan? I'm given something, what am I getting back? And that underlying attitude seems very important to deal with other people. Keeping people in business, I can't guarantee that no matter what I'm going to give, I'm going to get something back. And that seems as educational to do that. And I wonder if as a committee there might be pieces of the model that we could look at to change the attitude of what am I getting back on my dollar and try to connect to how can we help. Thank you. what am I getting for my dollar committee or lack of stuff? Any other thing that's special?
Thank you, Angela. Actually, I think you really hit the nail on the head. The problem is that when we were financing schools primarily through property tax, it was on the local level. The people knew their teachers. They knew people in the school. They could see the product. I mean, they didn't have to talk about it in a scientific way. They could see the product. Now the whole state is funding schools, and they don't see what's happening out there, and that's why the concern is, where's my money going to? You know, they're asking for more and more. And I think what this is an attempt, and right, a school isn't a business, but it's an attempt to have something that will demonstrate, imperfectly, but demonstrate in some way, that this is what your money is buying. In my mind today, we're still not back on the local level, but we're not. We have to deal with it. Move on.
Thank you, Judy. When I thought of the model, it was interesting because the first question I asked was, where was preschool? You know, if I thought of quality education, my first thought was, where was preschool? And it wasn't there. I mean, that doesn't mean that we can't put it there. And when I thought of quality education, I thought of a seamless education. So all of us are thinking of different things as we think of quality education and what goes into quality, and I think that's a part of our task, you know, when you really begin to look at it and look at of saying, yes, we know that dollars will drive some of the decisions, but also I think that if we don't develop something that says that quality is important in Oregon, we're not going to get to the dollars either.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you can get there unless we talk about and we really put a face on what is quality education. Okay. And that's where you are. You know what happens in the classroom, and you know what the classrooms are. You know, Elaine, she knows what it takes to make a school run, and even with all the variables. You know, I think it was an excellent point in talking about what happens when you have English as a second language. You can't expect the 90% there, and maybe we need to put that into that framework when we really go forward with some of our recommendations. So we can give some thoughts that I'm throwing out as we're thinking. We're going to do a lot of thinking between now and September 2000.
Thanks, mm-hmm. Madam Speaker. I'd like to throw out a thought since you alluded to the educators, and I'm totally going to put on my educator hat. When I look at the model, I see something that hopefully has a basis. I'm sick and tired of we educators getting beaten up for everything. Everything we do is our fault. If a kid, anything happens to a kid, it's the educator's fault. The school didn't do it. If they did do something, they did it wrong, or they didn't do enough of it. And I think we've been undergoing that for years. And I happen to believe that both the department and the quality ed model are, they're sure not perfect, and people know I've criticized all those figures as much as anybody, and probably behind closed doors more than some of you have. On the other hand, I think it's a way for us to fight back, if you will, and prove that what we're doing is valuable, is worthwhile. And I think there is a little bit of, at least from my point of view, one of the things I do is I hire the best business director in the whole state because that is not my strong suit. And so what I see this doing, and I think the initial charge, in deference to Jackie, that the charge to the group was to do K-12. If we want to do preschool, I mean, that certainly could happen, but I don't begrudge the fact that the model itself, the charge was to do K-12. But anyhow, I think the whole idea there is maybe to give us something where we can rise above some of the criticism that we all endure. And I said sarcastically, and Representative Wilson was asking, I don't see why we do this, and I sarcastically said, for the money, of course. And isn't it a shame to have to be sarcastic about that, too, because it is true. So that's off my soapbox. It's only twice I've gotten on it.
Pat, Madam Chair, this is Pat Moss, and I teach Spanish in Salem. And this is the first time I've served on the committee, so this has been a wonderful learning experience for me today, and I really appreciate all the comments that have been made.
a couple of comments from my perspective in foreign language. When I look at class size, professional development, duration of instruction time, operational support, seven developmental goals, I think those are a really good framework. I mean, it's a starting place. What I would like to see, rather than duration of instructional time, although that is a part of what's important, I think instruction is the key. And under instruction, duration is one aspect of that. But I think even more important than that is that we have well-articulated sequential programs that build upon a core. So often I think that we're fragmented. And the poor kids, they get, you know, the same curriculum here, the same curriculum there, and it's not a continuum. And they'll say, I already took that course. Or we had that back then and there. And I don't blame those kids, because as a parent, I see it with different eyes now through my own child. But in foreign language, that is absolutely crucial, that you have a long sequence and it's well articulated. Another part, when the professional development for teachers and administrators, I'm afraid that that's going to get seen as just having in-service days for teachers during the school year, and I'm not sure that that in itself is all that we're looking at. I don't see anywhere here, and for the intangible part of the passion, the love for what we're doing, my love for language as a tool because it leads me to someplace else, the love of the English, the love of the music because it helps you to reach other things and become a more complete person. And sometimes I think that that's missing with the kids. In our school newspaper this last week, I saw an article by a girl who just said, nobody tells us what it is we're supposed to be learning for. Well, I think the school probably has a problem. But still, I think that we need to, our teaching and our passion and our love and our intensity for, and our preparation and our field is very important. So I want to be careful that this professional development doesn't go in as to how to mark the bubbles on the sheet for the state test, because that's not what we're looking for professional development. And that when we're looking to hire, to prepare teachers, that we're looking at these components. And it's not just how to make a beautiful bulletin board. That's lovely. I wish I could do a better job of that. But I also think that it's a long time to prepare somebody to know their field well. And we need to look at that in teacher preparation and who we're preparing. As we are all dealing with active teachers in our schools, you know, we got to look at who we're pulling into the field, what we're dealing with. So I like the idea that the report deals with intangibles. And maybe those are some ideas for that.
Yes, Martin Monsieur from Corvallis. I agree with you about that whole idea. Teaching is not an exact science, as most of us know. One element that, Chair Winters, you said, you know, we can dream a little bit. One thing that I'd like to see us maybe address, which might be really important, I don't know how many people are aware of the changing demographics of our teaching group, but there are an extraordinarily large number of senior, what we'd like to call experienced, teachers, that will be leaving the profession in the next 5 to 10 years. And it's going to be have a dramatic impact, not just in Oregon, but across the nation. And one thing that I'd like to see us perhaps address in this quality education model is some resources for a true mentoring program where we can truly mentor teachers coming into the profession. While I agree with Chair Winters about the necessity for getting kids off to a good start, preschool would be a great start. Head Start is another area that we kind of really need to take a look at and make sure the kids have access to it. This all-day kindergarten concept that is in the model is a very, very, what I consider a very positive direction. We've done it in Corvallis on a fee basis. We do half-day kindergarten and support that, but then have parents on a sliding scale pay for fees for full-day kindergartens, not all, in every building, but we certainly try to make that effort. Those are the kinds of things that I think we could bring to this model and maybe help and enhance it. But one thing that is missing, and that is that whole idea of mentoring new teachers to make sure that they stay in the profession. One thing that we found through research is that many, many teachers leave the field within the first 3 to 5 years because of the intensity of the work we do and the expectations and sometimes the lack of support and certainly the criticism and the bashing that we get in the media. And I'm sorry that Representative Wilson left a little early. He was talking about the good old days back in the 50s and 60s. Well, I don't want to bust his bubble because he's not here. But we were only graduating about 30-40% of our kids from our high school set during those lovely years and during the good old years because we really didn't concern ourselves with students with disabilities or children that spoke English as a second language. And many of the things that we address today, and we're doing remarkably well, getting many more students through the system and graduating with skills than they did in the good old days. I went to school during that same period of time, had a wonderful childhood experience in school, was relatively successful as a student, had a lot of parent support. But at the same time, there were a lot of students that I sure would like to know what happened to them because they disappeared when they reached their 14, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old age levels. And there were no laws that said that we had to kind of address issues like that. So I think we have a lot to go, but I'd like to dream a little too. So I'll try to do that in the next several weeks.
I got Representative GML. Okay.
Madam Chairman, I was just going to ask, is it Martin? I can't quite read the last name, Martin.
Yeah.
You were talking about that you were suggesting having someone to mentor the new teachers. Like, what would your suggestion be? Like, one educator to two or three new teachers, or?
I think ideally, as we look at some interesting mentoring programs that are going on now, there's one in. I'm not sure what school district it is, somewhere in the metro area where they got some grant money. It's a one-on-one process generally with mentoring to provide that kind of support. And the question that always arises for those of us that are in the classrooms and spending 50, 60 hours a week just trying to maintain is time, the issue of time. Mm-hmm. Having the time to be, the release time to be able to really work with a mentoring teacher and to be able to share things and get them through the early years when it's really tough and you're kind of trying to feel your way about. Those of us that started, we were pretty much thrown into a classroom by ourselves, and we had to sink or swim, and many of us survived with incredible sweat and blood and tears. But I think to answer Representative Gianella's question, I think a one-to-one would be ideal, and there are some model programs out there that we might want to take a look at. I'm trying to remember the district that of a model that really seems to have one that's off and running. And when I think about that, I'll share that with the group.
Follow up, Madam Chairman. Martin, let's see, would the mentor, would they spend the full school day? Would they spend the whole day in the classroom or just a few hours?
I think it would be kind of a year program process, at least a year, where you'd really be able to spend. The new teachers are, you know, pretty well trained to be able to take over. We wouldn't hire them and pay them if they couldn't handle a classroom. But I think that the mentoring program would be a pretty, you know, year-long experience that I think would really help maintain, just provide the support so teachers wind up staying in the profession, especially the really high-quality, good ones that we'd like to see and entice into our profession. When they can start out as an engineer and make $45,000 a year and start out as a teacher at 22, 23 with the responsibilities we have, it's pretty tough to entice people to come and then stay when they see some alternatives. So I think it would be a year-long kind of commitment.
Jan just surprised me that there is a bill in to revive the mentoring program that has been introduced by the Department of Ed.
Should it be in the bill?
It's a bill. 366.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so glad you said something, Martin, because I was sitting here listening to Representative Wilson, and I went to school during the 40s and 50s. And not only was the classroom environment different, but the world was different. And you could leave school early and go to work in the steel mills or the forest or the auto factories. There's very little information. You just need a strong body. What I really want to say, I back Representative Chair Winters' idea of expanding it. I don't know if we were limited to K-12. I think it's extremely important to think about preschool because in order to have a successful model you have to have children, or it's important to have children ready to learn when they come into the first grade. And I think we do need to have take that into consideration. And finally, I want to bring up that a gentleman in the audience asked me about this, and I couldn't answer. But is there any representation on this board for special needs, whether it's a special needs teacher or somebody who has a perspective on that, because they felt that that should be part of the dialogue we're having? And I couldn't answer that question.
That's a good point.
I don't know if it helps. Glenn Colangelo, I don't know if it helps, but of the 24 kids that we have, they're all foster and adopted children, and they have lots of different needs.
Tiffany, Kate, I'm kind of jumping back to the mentoring thing, but it was my school district, which is Gresham and Barlow, that did the mentoring program this year, and we had a grant money to do that, and while I was not part of that program, first-year teachers were, and they were mentored with an experienced teacher, and it seemed to be very helpful. Another person on my grade level was mentored, and they spent a week before school started, and that seemed to be the most valuable thing, and the older teacher was paid to do that and spent time helping them set up their classroom and helping them learn what their expectations would be, and it seemed to be a very helpful thing. So whatever it's worth, if you could support that Senate bill, it'd be a good thing.
Rep. Jenny Backlund and then
Pat Moss. I would like to just dovetail to what you're saying. We did have a mentoring program at the school I'm in, and it sounded like it was similar to yours, and indeed that week prior to school would be the best time because it's the least frenzied time, and you're setting the framework for the rest of the year. But, and I don't want to encourage without money, but as we were saying, money doesn't solve everything. It's not a guarantee. Through the Confederation of Oregon Foreign Language Teachers, we realized that it's a vital. So at our fall conference, and I highly recommend that, it's been a very strong professional development for us, that we have coordinated experienced, successful teachers with new teachers in the district. And I've had the pleasure of working on that this year. And I would have loved to have had that full week ahead, but we weren't assigned that early. But talking on the phone helps, even just meeting a couple times at one school, finding out what the needs are, and then dealing with those needs. It doesn't have to be expensive. It's not like that teacher doesn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just working to their strengths and helping out, but it doesn't have to cost a lot.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's kind of the subject is mentoring with me, too, here, and teacher retention. I saw some statistics the other day. I'm a member of the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and after the third year, 50% of the teachers, new teachers, have dropped out. And it is believed, studies have shown, and there are lots of good studies out there if we would use them, studies have shown that mentoring will definitely maintain a much higher percentage of teacher retention. And I was Salem Kaiser used to have a mentoring program, and I thought it was a very good program. It was all year long, not a lot of time on any one given day, but like at least 90 hours in the course of the year, and so that was frequent contact in the weeks. I think the Department of Education estimated that a mentoring program like we used to have some years ago was like an $8 million price tag. And that program has been dropped, and I don't know what the Senate bill, I've not seen the Senate bill, but I think that is would be a very good investment in terms of successful teachers.
Tom? Oh. Go ahead, Tom.
Tom Gentry. What's been talked about, things going through my head, a lot of things written down, but going through a lot of the model, one of the things that I really look at heavily, coming from a rural school district down in the South, we do a lot of busing, and since it's been mandated, we've seen our district at least sends out a lot of buses to pick up these kids off some far-off road, and I looked specifically at the full implementation part of the elementary school, and it said $241 per student, so I asked, got some information, and basically our school district spends anywhere from 2 to 3 times more for busing just because we to get those kids, we have to go out and reach out to them to get them. And we're not just, that's not just for elementary, that's for middle school and that's for high school also. So when you look at this, you know, cost-wise, we're going to have to spend quite a bit more just for busing to even make up where somebody other in the city doesn't have to do as much busing so they can implement some other type of program that might help students. We're spending all our money on busing. You also mentioned about a wish, dream list. I look at the beginning on page 10, and this was a very interesting statement that was made. It says in the second paragraph right at the end of it, it says, has the state properly met its moral obligation to provide a quality education for every student in Oregon? Being a public school teacher, I've been harassed, in a sense, because of basically the way we started out our my children. My boy is a strong-willed child. And I felt, and my wife and I felt, that at the time, to enter him in school would be a disservice, not only to him, but to some teacher. So we did the homeschooling. And I felt I was lucky in that sense, in being a public school teacher, being able to get the resources to help my wife work with our child. And I felt she did a fantastic job. I felt my child now is a lot better off by being homeschooled. Not taking away from public school, but because of the size of the classrooms, the amount of time that that teacher could have spent with my child, my wife, I felt, did a better job. Not putting down the teacher, but I felt my wife did a better job. When it talks about provide a quality education for every student in Oregon, are we reaching out to all students in Oregon? And I have to say no. And I feel that I think we need to reach out to any parent that wants help with their child, no matter whether they're homeschooling, whatever. I think we need to reach out to them and work with them in some way. The other one was I really look at the intangibles and the tangibles on this, and I agree with a lot of them. But there's a lot more, I think, that could be put in there that sure, there might be costs involved, but there are other ones that I feel that need to be addressed. A big one is, you know, we hold the teachers accountable. They're responsible for all this, whether it's the assessments, whatever it is, and giving the quality education for their child. But I think some way or somehow we need to hold parents accountable and make them responsible for the education and the rearing of their children. Thank you.
Jennifer.
Yes, I'm for Ross. And I was tagging along my things to my dear brother. One of my dream beliefs is that it is possible to include
there is a bill in our committee.
The other thing that I would love to say is, and I also, when you talk about special needs, I'm assuming you meant kind of special education by all sorts of
It's been a wonderful dialogue tonight, and a lot of information and a lot of sharing. I'm going to ask staff to take all of this information that you have given tonight and to begin looking at areas of study, because you really have thrown out a lot, and I think it's wonderful. And our next meeting will be on the 11th of May, and we will invite the Department of Education.
Yeah, are
yes.
We going to do these?
No, not tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Linda Verdorn. This is sort of a housekeeping issue, I guess, but I really preferred the other room as opposed to this room, particularly when we have presentations, because me sitting here, I see the back of whoever's presenting, and it's just not really acceptable to do that.
We will try. We're competing with all of the committees, and I know that maybe you did try to move in to get the other room.
We're in room 50, I have 5 microphones, and I talked to the technical people, and they say they can't add microphones. So that's a problem for a group this large, because we need to record what everyone's saying. And so I think once session is over, we can probably remake a hearing room, so it's much more informal and better meets our needs. We're rather hard pressed during session to find a room that accommodates such a big group.
Madam Chair.
But we'll do what we can. Yeah.
Madam Chair, we could have them stand over here and face that way. That would work.
We can build up.
Sure.
Bring you some here. But we will see what we can do to accommodate. With that, the any other the meeting is adjourned.
Didn't this one go by fast?
I did. I want my answer.